piece you're about to hear defined renowned pianist Leon Fleischer's first career in music. He began playing that piece at age 12. At the height of his career, he was considered one of the greatest classical pianists of the 20th century. But after a mysterious ailment forced him to give up playing with both hands, Leon Fleischer discovered there was more than one way to sustain a life in music. He's written a memoir of his ongoing career as pianist, teacher, and conductor with music critic Anne Majette. It's titled My Nine Lives, and Leon Fleischer and Anne Majette join me in the studio. It's so wonderful to see you both. Good morning to you, Leon.
Good morning, Diane. It's wonderful to be with you.
Good
again.
Morning to you, Anne.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you both are here. And as I look into our engineer studio, I see your beautiful daughter, Leah, who yes. is my marvelous Pilates instructor. And, of course, throughout the hour, we will take your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. That Brahms D minor concerto just seems so extraordinarily difficult to me for a 12-year-old to have been playing.
Well, difficult maybe in the meditative, contemplative, what that business of eventually what you come to with music is not so much the notes or even, as many people say, the space between the notes, but eventually you start listening for the implications of the notes. And I'm not so sure a young kid, no matter how gifted physically for the instrument, I'm not sure those implications are immediately accessible. However, I just remember that piece, when I first heard it, made my hair stand on end. And it hasn't changed since.
Does it still make your hair stand on end?
Oh, yeah. Well, but the bittersweet quality of this is just, irresistible.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And Majette, how did you and Leon Fleischer come together on this book?
We were kind of an arranged marriage. The publisher had met Leon and thought it would be a great idea for a book and thought that we should work together on it. And so we had, in effect, a blind date in Baltimore one night. Mm-hmm. It was right at the time I was beginning at the Washington Post. It was the same week I began at the Washington Post. And I came up to Baltimore to hear the symphony for my first ever Post review and to have dinner with Leon beforehand.
Oh, my.
And I remember him telling me about George Sell at that dinner and thinking, oh, we really would have a book here.
First dates aren't always that successful.
No, this we hit it off. I was most impressed by Anne's awareness and sensitivity, and it seemed just made to order. I was able to speak of memories and feelings, thoughts. And I felt totally comfortable, so thank you again.
Well, for me, the pleasure was all mine. It was such an opportunity for me to be able to work with somebody like Leon. And as people asked me yesterday at an event I was at, did I really get to sit in a room and ask him anything I wanted?
And I'm sure you did.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you did. Leon, you talk in this book a great deal about not only your early years, your love for music, your father, your mother, the fact that your father, I gather, was not terribly interested in music, but your mother was.
I don't really understand where it all comes from. My mother, towards the end, she died of breast cancer at the age of 53, a young woman, and her education was incomplete, I think, to a large degree. But she found enormous solace and comfort in the writings of Emerson. And she would sit when she had nothing else, or when she had a few moments free, I should say, and just read Ralph Waldo Emerson. I don't know where this need or this connection with music came from. She was not musical herself, she didn't play an instrument, as you say, nor did my father.
But she wanted you to.
Yes. She actually, I think she might have wanted for my brother. He was 5 and a half years older, and he was the one that got the piano lessons.
He played first.
Yes, he played first and was not particularly interested. And I remember in those days, not only did your piano teacher, but your doctor came to the house.
Ah, yes.
Yes. I don't think you remember those days, but I do. And the teacher, Ray's teacher, came to the house, and I would kind of hide in the corner. I would curl up and listen to his lessons. And when his lessons were over, he'd go out and play ball in the schoolyard. And I went to the piano and reproduced the lessons.
You were able to do that.
It didn't seem like much of a problem then. And I enjoyed it. And it was soon noticed that I had this strange little habit of being able to do this. And so they gave the lessons to me. And my brother very happily spent the rest of that free time playing ball.
Right. And that would have been the first of what you call your 9 lives.
Yes, yes. That's my introduction to music and my first lessons and learning about all the cookies that were available to a little kid, you know.
And Jet, that must have been an interesting beginning for you to delve into as you worked with Leon.
Well, absolutely. You know, when you're working on a book together, the stories don't come out chronologically. Mm-hmm. So you find bits and pieces as you go. And I remember sitting at my desk and putting together those first stories and discovering or really delving into the history of San Francisco at the time musically, which is fascinating. And Leon was an eyewitness to a lot of the great conductors who shaped San Francisco's musical life before he met Arthur Schnabel. Theodore Herz was a big influence, and then playing with the WPA orchestras. And it was a wonderful chapter in history that I hadn't known about, and then we could go back and elaborate on it together.
Of course, the first concert, the first public concert you gave, you were what, 8 years old?
Yes. I think my mother strategically said I was 7.
No, I didn't
but
know
I was
that.
Eight. Well, I can't tell you everything all the time. And what I do remember about that is that I had to be quite perfect in a way. I was already wearing glasses, and I remember walking from backstage through the curtain onto the brightly lit stage. And as I approached that point where I left backstage and became visible to the public walking towards the piano, my mother, who was standing there, snaked out her arm and snatched my glasses off my face. Because, of course, you know, the glasses were a sign of imperfection and I had to be perfect. So I you know, the piano's a pretty big instrument. I could see, and generally speaking, where it was and the keyboard.
Because you were playing from memory, you did not have to read music and therefore did not need your glasses. Thank heavens.
Gee, you really know about that.
With a son and daughter, both of whom play the piano. I do know about that.
Wonderful.
We are going to take a short break here. Leon Fleischer is here, along with Ann Midgett. Together, they've written My Nine Lives. We'll take a short break right back.
More Diane Rehm Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5 and 88.3 at Ocean City, Maryland. Hope you're enjoying your afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Asundio.
And I'm Communications Director Kay Summers.
The District of Columbia's HIV/AIDS office says at least 3% of D.C. residents have HIV or AIDS, and that's one of the highest rates in the nation.
Local organizations are providing medical services, support groups, and therapy to help those who are infected reclaim their lives.
Pediatric AIDS HIV Care Incorporated is the only group in the D.C. area devoted to support services for children.
Pediatric AIDS HIV Care's programs include expressive arts therapy and grief counseling to help children better understand their experiences and losses.
The Northern Virginia AIDS Ministry supports people living with AIDS or HIV, educates the community about HIV/AIDS, and works to combat the fear and prejudice surrounding HIV/AIDS.
More information is at WAMU.org. Click on Community.
Your unwanted vehicle will help pay for the programming you value when you donate it to WAMU 88.5. Call 866-WAMU-444 or donate online at WAMU.org.
This program of the Diane Rehm Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
And we're back with Leon Fleischer, the absolutely outstanding and glorious musician who's got a new book. It's a look back at what he calls My Nine Lives. The book was written with Washington Post music critic Ann Midgett. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Leon Fleischer, one of our early callers, wants you to talk about Arthur Schnabel.
It's both at one and the same time an extraordinary joy and yet not too easy. He was the thing that I remember most about Schnabel and his teaching, his music making, was the level, the consistent level, high level of inspiration. Everything that he did, when he put his hands on the keyboard and depressed those keys, had nothing to do or very little to do with actual piano playing, but it was music making at its highest level. It really took one out of one's body. It was an out-of-body kind of experience.
How old were you when you first met him?
Well, he had been contacted by the two conductors in San Francisco when I was 9. Those conductors being Hertz and Pierre Monteux, who was then the current conductor of the San Francisco Orchestra. And he was contacted because they both thought that he should become my teacher. And he wrote a very nice letter back but saying he didn't accept students under the age of 16 because of I think the phrase he used was language problems. Not so much that I couldn't speak German or he couldn't speak English. His English was extraordinary. But that conceptually I wouldn't understand the abstractions in which he dealt. That's the other thing. His voice he sounded like Richard Burton with a German accent.
Oh my.
And he just relished each syllable. It rolled over in his mouth. It was a joy to listen to, really.
So after he initially said, I do not take students under the age of 16,
right.
Then what happened?
Oh, he came to San Francisco. Every time he came, he had dinner with the Hertzes and played bridge after dinner. And I was snuck into the house through the garage basement. So that when they threw open the doors from the dining room to the living room where the piano stood, I was sitting at the piano.
And how old were you?
I was 9.
And
he, being a gentleman, I imagine he sighed a sigh and agreed to listen to me. And after I played for him, he asked if I would be willing or able and or able to come to Lake Como in Italy that very summer. And this was, you know, long before George Clooney discovered Lake Como.
Wow. What a story.
Oh.
What a story.
It was quite something. And then all the clouds gathering in Europe, 1938 was. Mm. And that turned out to be Schnabel's last summer in Italy.
Europe.
Yeah, he came to New York, made his home in the Peter Stuyvesant Hotel, 86th Street in Central Park West, apartment 9C. I remember it very clearly.
Because you went there.
Yes.
For your lessons.
Right. And also rather than returning to San Francisco, my mother and I made home in New York. And eventually, I think the following year, my brother and father joined us in New York. So
now, the story of your hand beginning to cramp begins in what year?
That I became really aware was 1964. It took almost 10 months for it to completely resist me, to curl the fourth and fifth fingers, curl under into my palm, and being able to straighten out the hand only with the most enormous of efforts.
And you were at the time playing concert after concert.
Oh, yeah. I was sailing high. I was playing with the world's great orchestras, with the world's great conductors. I had made a whole series of recordings with George Sell, the Beethoven Concerti, the two Brahms, Mozart, Rachmaninoff, Paganini Rhapsody, all that good stuff.
And you watched as your hand curled and would not, no matter what you tried, you could not get that hand to respond.
There was that, but even more frustrating was that the medical profession didn't know what to make of this. And that's really despair-provoking.
They kept telling you, as they told me, it's all in your head.
Well, there was that question. And I tried everything, as I say, from aromatherapy to Zen Buddhism. And went and had any number of sessions with psychologists and analysts, and they assured me they couldn't find any discernible reason. They thought it was physical.
And Majette, I was surprised and interested to read in the book about this period, because in it, Leon acknowledged to you and to the world that he became so despairing that he contemplated suicide.
It was a black period, and I think it must have been an incredibly difficult period for Leon to talk about and certainly to write about, because describing in words how horrible it feels to go through something like that is a hard thing to do. But yes, and on the surface, it appears that life did continue, that he continued teaching and that he was still active at the same time as trying to deal with the unimaginable. I think when it first happened, you don't realize it's going to last for as long as it ends up lasting, and you just think it's going to end each and every day.
And for the next 3 decades, it did, in fact, last. And you, Leon, began to not only teach and conduct, but to play with the left hand. And certainly one of the pieces you chose to play was the Ravel Piano Concerto. Must have given you great satisfaction to be able to play again, but great frustration to play with one hand.
Well, once I decided, it took about 2 years from the onset of this focal dystonia until I decided enough of this self-pity. That there were other ways that I could satisfy that need of continuing a productive life in music, which, as you've said, I did through expanded teaching, although I had been teaching since 1959 at the Peabody in Baltimore, conducting. And finally admitting that if I wanted to play, there was a literature for left hand, a rather extensive literature in terms of concertos, pieces for left hand and orchestra, thanks to one Paul Wittgenstein, who had lost his arm in World War I and being a very wealthy man, decided to commission works for Left Hand. And that was very satisfying. This work that you just played, the Ravel, is one of the great, great masterpieces of music, be it for one hand or 17 hands. It's just one of the... It's not long. It's 18 minutes, but it traverses human experience.
Leon Fleischer playing Ravel's Piano Concerto for the Left Hand in D, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask now about what it was that finally led you to be bold enough to experiment with the injection of the deadliest poison known to man and woman into your right arm.
Well, I had tried everything else, just about everything else. So these wonderful people down at NIH and Dan Trachman in Baltimore, neurologist at Hopkins, when they said this is, you know, it's a new program, would I be interested in becoming a part of it? I somehow thought and felt that the same way the problem appeared, like out of the blue and unannounced, as it were, should or could possibly disappear in the same way. You know, I'm a great one, I guess, for denial.
Do you remember that first injection?
Well, I had had, at the very beginning, one of the great hand doctors in the world, Ray Curtis, after whom the Curtis Clinic is founded in Baltimore, Union Memorial Hospital, he gave me an injection into the wrist of some kind of anesthetic, and it worked. I was able to play again. It was like magic. That was at the very beginning, in 64, when this happened. He was never again able to duplicate that. When the effects of that injection wore off, the focal dystonia had returned. So I had this as a kind of example, teasing, tantalizing, you know, it happened once, Buster, why couldn't it happen again? You
know? But rather than anesthetic, now what was proposed was poison.
Yeah, well, you know, if you stop to look at what our modern medicine is based on.
Lots of poison.
That's not so unusual.
Lots of poison.
Lots of poison.
So botulinum toxin went into your forearm and affected those two last fingers.
Actually, as I understand it, it's a minute amount that they inject.
Exactly.
And it the effect of it is to somewhat paralyze those flexing muscles, those curling under muscles. And if they are paralyzed a little bit, they don't clench as strongly, and they allow the opposing muscles to do their work, the extensors, and that's the way I can keep my fingers extended a little bit They do move up and down. So everything I do is a question of adjustment. It's quite a tightrope to walk. It's quite a balancing act.
It's quite a balancing act for a man who is now, forgive me, 82.
Yes.
Conducting a full schedule of performances, not only here in the United States, but around the world.
That's what I do, I guess.
It's what you do.
Yeah.
I understand that very well.
Thank you, dear.
And I'm so glad you continue to do it, as is the world, and I'm sure Anne Majette. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll open the phones for your questions, your comments for Leon Fleischer and Anne Majette. The new book, a memoir, is titled My Nine Lives. Stay with us.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, international climate talks wrap up in Cancun, what was and wasn't accomplished for protecting the environment. Plus, sports and politics collide. A local player gets national attention for his political beliefs, and off-field drama engulfs the Redskins again. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
And if you will go to the DR Show website, you will link to clips of Leon Fleischer's music, which are spoken of in the book My Nine Lives, which Leon Fleischer, together with Anne Majette, the Washington Post music critic, have written together. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, Diane. I do enjoy your show so much.
Thank you.
Special pleasure today to have Leon Fleischer there, and I have a few comments and a question for him. I had the extreme pleasure of sitting a few meters away in my Maimandi concert hall when he was a stand-in for another pianist, and he played us a Mozart piano concerto. I don't remember the exact number, but I do remember it's the most beautiful rendering of Mozart I've had in a live performance. I rushed out to get his disc of Two Hands, and the Schubert B-flat major rendition there is such a knockout. It's something I give to my friends, and they're equally amazed. I was curious, what was it like working with George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra? When did this relationship of Leon Fleischer with Zell begin, and can he tell us something about anecdotes and the experience and the musicianship behind that?
What a wonderful question, George. Thank you. George adored Schnabel, my teacher. They were close friends. They actually had recorded this D minor Brahms concerto together. In fact, that was the present that my parents, my folks, got for me when I was about 12. And when I first heard it, that was the occasion of my first hearing of the piece. So George, I think, found out about me from Schnabel. And my greatest fantasies after hearing this recording when I was 12 was maybe someday I'd be able to play this with the great Zell. And that actually came to pass in summertime of 1946 with Chicago Orchestra at Ravinia. And my next fantasy was, maybe wouldn't that be unbelievable if I could record this with George? And that came true in the late 50s. What was it like to work with him? It was a combination of intimidation, fear. He had these pale blue eyes that would pierce you. They were not hidden. They were magnified by those Coke bottle glasses that he wore. He had the most extraordinary and demanding standards as a musician. He felt very strongly that it was not important to be loved, a condition that was espoused by, let's say, somebody like Lenny Bernstein, but it was important to be respected. And he built out of the Cleveland Orchestra a group that was among the best, four or five best orchestras in the world. So anybody that agreed to work with him in effect subscribed to similar, if not the same, standards. So it was really tough in a way, but his music making was extraordinary, and he was supportive and he was like an uncle in a way.
You had so many of your fantasies fulfilled. It's almost as though you have to be careful what you wish for.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. On all levels, musical, personal, whatever you decide.
Exactly. Thank you for your call, George. That was lovely. Let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Diane. I called this morning. I'm the retired bass player and librarian at the Utah Symphony, and I had the thrill of playing with Leon in Stuttgart, Germany in 2005. He did the Prokofiev Fourth, the concerto for the left hand. And my memory was that as an encore, he played Sheep May Safely Graze, which is on the Two Hands recording that he did. And it was so thrilling to hear him play a concerto for the left hand and then to play the Bach with both hands.
Mm.
And I remember the people in Stuttgart coming up as I was picking up the music, and they wanted to know what he had played. And I told him it was just one of these, it was just transfiguring. He played it with such artistry, such beauty. And he was one of the most wonderful human beings, is one of the most wonderful human beings I ever had the pleasure to meet in my career.
Patrick, my goodness, thank you. Thank you. Yes, Sheep May Safely Graze, it's what I now call the environmentalist's anthem. I'm happy to play that most anywhere.
You know, there is another favorite of yours, but first I want to ask whether you remembered that performance that Patrick talked about.
Yes, I've actually done several tours with different orchestras of Germany. Curiously enough, playing that Prokofiev Fourth.
Interesting.
It's not a well-known piece. It's a piece of extraordinary imagination and class, as it were, amongst the whole output of Prokofiev.
I want to ask you about a piece that is quite well known and one which you tend to regard as one of your favorites.
Thank you.
Tell me why that is such a favorite.
Well, it's self-evident in a way, but what it somehow for me represents is without sounding like a cliche, it's kind of the way existence is. It's kind of the way life is. It flows. It flows inevitably, inexorably, peacefully at times. Not this piece violently, but other music. Music does that. Music takes us out of ourselves and makes us somehow better.
I could listen to that forever. Now we'll go back to the phones to Jonathan in Chester, Vermont. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's an honor to speak to you and an honor to speak to Mr. Fleischer as well.
Thank you.
I am a grand student of Mr. Fleischer. I studied with a student of his, and when I was young and ignorant and thought I knew everything, I was studying the Beethoven C major concerto, and my teacher was trying to get me to do it a certain way, and I didn't like that. And he said, you know, when I studied this with Leon Fleischer, and up until that point, I hadn't known that he'd studied with Leon. And when he said that, I thought, oh, I guess I'd better listen to him. And I did.
Well, Jonathan, it makes sense that you did, considering that your teacher had that experience. How did it ultimately turn out for you?
Well, it turned out the way that I think every teacher hopes his student will learn, a combination of their own ideas and those of their teacher. But it was an important moment in my musical career, learning to, you know, not think that you know everything and listen to your teacher.
Well, I think, Jonathan, thank you, first of all. And secondly, it's a not ignoble line of succession that you follow here. You know, my teacher, Schnabel, who was therefore your great musical great-grandfather, he studied with Leschetizky. Leschetizky studied with Czerny, and Czerny studied with Beethoven. So you're following in a kind of nice lineage there. I must bring us back, though, to reality. There is a weak link in that chain, and that weak link is Mr. Leschetizky, who taught everybody in the world who played piano.
Including Paul Wittgenstein.
Indeed.
Right.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And you, we must say, taught Andre Watts.
Yes, I had the great pleasure of sharing learning experiences with Andre. He was very young. What a brilliant talent.
The person who is with you at the piano for this last piece we're going to hear an excerpt from is your wife, Catherine.
Yes.
With whom you have performed.
Yes.
In places around the world. This is the Mozart Concerto number 7 in F major. Why did you choose to perform this piece?
Well, Mozart wrote a famous concerto for two pianos. This concerto that Catherine and I are playing is the concerto for three pianos, reduced by Mozart for two pianos, because the third piano was not that difficult.
What's it like performing with your wife?
Oh, you know, it ranges from wondrous to having our problems. Catherine has professed to having discovered new tort law. There is, you know, one of the big challenges in playing four hands, one piano is who pedals and for whom do they pedal? For whom the bell tolls. Anyway, the tort law that she is proposing is called irreconcilable peddling as a reason for divorce. But as you listen to this music, it is such extraordinary joy and spirited and you can't help but feel better after listening to it.
You'd never know that there were problems beneath the piano.
No, they're the wonderful problems.
I want to read to you as we listen to this glorious music a final email from Philip here in Washington, who says, every year I celebrate Beethoven's birthday on December 16th by listening to most of his symphonies, all of his concertos. When it comes to listening to the piano concertos, I listen exclusively to the Leon Fleischer, George Sell, Cleveland Orchestra recordings for all five concertos. I hope you continue to perform and continue to enjoy performing for many, many years to come, Leon. What a wonderful pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Diane, and may I extend the same wishes to you.
Thank you. And Anne Midget, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Azerbaijan asking, what's an ushuk?
something should stir in your soul and lead you to become an Ashik.
This is Anna Oldfield, a professor from Hamilton College, describing an Ashik's calling. She spent years recording Ashiks in rural Azerbaijan. She says they're a combination of storyteller and musician. Oldfield calls them
the keepers of cultural memory.
They play a lute-like instrument called a saz, and they tell epics or compete in verbal duels. A duel might go something like this.
One Ashik will play the saz and sing perhaps a riddle or a question that demands an answer. And they'll sing it in verse with a certain rhyme and a certain meter. And the other Ashik has to improvise an answer in the same rhyme, in the same meter.
They've been around for more than 500 years. During the Soviet era, they were deemed a proletarian art form. But their epics were temporarily upstaged by having to sing in praise of Stalin.
And the amazing thing about the Ashik songs is that while you can burn books,
and Stalin burned many,
you can't burn oral narrative. So Ashiks were able to continue to tell the epics of their heritage and pass them to the next generation.
Social criticism has always been part of the genre, Oldfield says, and they often
sing about tragedies that have happened to their people to be a voice for the nation and a voice for the people that are suffering.
Ashiks these days learn from a master, but in years past, younger Ashiks apprentice themselves to an older Ashik, and they learn his repertoire and live with him for years.
And then when the apprentice was considered ready, again, this is a tradition that's not followed so much anymore, the older Ashik would slap him in the face and say, okay, now you're ready.
Oldfield describes one of the famous epics, a kind of Romeo and Juliet.
Asli is an Armenian girl and Kerem is an Azerbaijani boy. They fall in love and they want to get married, but their parents object.
Eventually, of course, love prevails.